Welcome to Dr. Emmett Miller's Healing Times Radio, Conversations with Extraordinary People. This show can be heard on Dream Vision 7 Radio Network every Friday at 1 p.m. and 1 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, 10 a.m. and 10 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. Go to dreamvision7radio.com, click Listen Live, and enjoy the show.
Dr. Bruce Lipton is a scientist and an internationally recognized leader in bridging science and spirit. His career has paralleled mine in a most interesting way. He began his scientific career as a cell biologist, receiving a PhD from the University of Virginia before joining the Department of Anatomy at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine in 1973. And by way of reference, that was the year I published my first book, Selective Awareness, introducing the field of mind-body medicine, how the mind can influence the behavior of the cells of the body and facilitate the healing process. Meanwhile, Dr. Lipton was doing research on muscular dystrophy using cloned human stem cells, exploring the molecular mechanisms that control cell behavior. In 1982, the year my book Software for the Mind was published, Bruce had begun examining the principles of quantum physics and how they might be integrated into his understanding of the cell's information processing systems. He produced breakthrough studies on the cell membrane, which revealed that this outer layer of the cell was an organic homolog of a computer chip, the cell's equivalent of a brain. His research at Stanford University School of Medicine, a half mile from my Menlo Park office, revealed that the environment, operating through the membrane, controlled the behavior and physiology of the cell, turning genes on and off. This, of course, ran counter to the established scientific view that life is controlled by the genes, and presaged one of today's most important fields of study, the science of epigenetics. Dr. Lipton's novel scientific approach transformed his personal life as well. He applied it to his personal biology and discovered that his physical well-being improved and the quality and character of his daily life was greatly enhanced. Bruce, welcome to Healing Times Radio.
Oh, I so appreciate this opportunity, Emmett, and thank you for your history as well of bringing out to the world an understanding that we're really not the victims that conventional medicine suggests we are.
Amen. Well, in my conversations with many people in my field and in allied fields, I noticed that their move from that old paradigm of seeing us as victims to that newer paradigm, which recognizes the power that we do have to positively impact our healing and our lives. Their breakthrough often came in the form of a kensho, a sudden awakening or enlightenment. And in your book, The Biology of Belief, Unleashing the Power of Consciousness, Matter, and Miracles, you write about how a scientific epiphany precipitated rather a instantaneous personal transformation in your life. What did you learn at that moment?
Well, to precede that point in my life, I have to say that when I was very young and heard spiritual advice from elders around me, there was some part of my awareness as a child that said, you know, somehow or other, these people, their lives never match anything that they talk about in their spiritual conversation. And so I had pretty much doubted the nature of spirituality and really gravitated mm-hmm. towards science as science is going to be the truth of the world because it's a truth on this side of the planet and it's a truth on the other. So it's a global truth thing. I said, that's where to go. And mm-hmm. I let go of spirituality as being relevant to anything and mm-hmm. You know, and got into the science and trained as a conventional biologist, looking at the body as a physical mechanism of biochemicals controlled by genes, and was even teaching that to medical students. So I was not spiritual, not interested in even looking for it, so it wasn't like anything on my radar at all. I was really locked into the mechanism of life. And when I had that special evening, I was just culminating an understanding of how environmental information was regulating the biology of the cell and regulating gene activity. And the interface was this membrane that you mentioned, and And I was at that moment understanding the molecular nature of the membrane, and I realized, oh my God, it's the equivalent of a computer chip. And as I was typing this data in on my computer, I realized that the computer has all these programs and everything, but it's really somebody on the outside that is driving the computer. And that's when I recognized that each one of us is a different entity based on biology, and that I can't transplant my cells into your body without your immune system rejecting them as not self, and vice versa. And so everybody has a self. And at the moment of understanding the nature of the membrane, how it worked, I saw that on the surface of the cell there are sets of antennas that are almost like keys on a keyboard. And they're like combination locks. They have different frequencies associated with them. And what's interesting about it is that every human has a different set of these antennas, and it's sort of like a PIN number to get into the computer, in a sense. And yet, what I realized as I was typing the data into the computer, that I personally, biologically, the identity of me is not even inside the cell. It's whatever is typing on the membrane on what we call self-receptors, which is an interesting name, receivers of self. Mm-hmm. And so basically, in this moment of like understanding the nature of it, I said, oh my God, I'm not inside this cell. I'm an identity that comes from the environment and plays through the cell. And what blew my mind, of course, was instantaneously was the vision of, well, to make an analogy, the body's like a television set tuned to mine is tuned to the Bruce station, and I'm playing the Bruce show here in my television set. and what I realized at that very instant of time is, yeah, but if the television breaks and we say the television is dead, it doesn't mean the broadcast stopped. And all of a sudden I realized, oh my God, our identity is part of something in the environment that plays through these antennas, and it's not our body, so that if the body dies, the identity is still there. And it was like, oh my God, this moment of, you know, biochemical machine transformed instantly to, oh my God, it's a remote control device run by this whatever identity out in the field. And it was like, okay, so what do you say about spirituality? Well, 10 seconds before, it was like, there wasn't even a question in my life. And then 10 seconds later, it was like, oh my God, my identity's not in here. Well, obviously, in that case, it's part of the environment by definition. Oh, okay, that's spiritual. So it was a very greatly transforming moment. It was interesting because I mentioned the instant that I recognized the validity of my belief system. I mean, it was my personal looking at the science and how it worked, and I said, oh my God, I'm not in there. And it was interesting because this weight lifted off of my life. I didn't know it was there until it wasn't there, in a sense. Like, that was just the way my life is, and all of a sudden, whoop, it got lighter all of a sudden. And I realized in the end, we spend unconsciously, it's totally unconsciously, an inordinate amount of time in every action that we do on this planet, in every movement that we do. There's this vision looking behind, watching every step. And this vision is the biology related to survival. It's actually something that biologists call the biological imperative. We know we can define it, but we don't know where it is or how it works. But it's basically every organism, from a bacteria all the way up to the highest organism on the planet, if it's threatened with death, will make every maneuver possible to stay alive, meaning there's some drive to stay alive.
Yeah.
Even for a bacterium, it's not going to sit there and say, okay, kill me. And so we all have this biological imperative. We all read our safety. It's almost like a safety gauge to let you know if you're in threat or not. And this is very interesting because in today's world, a lot of people are feeling this gauge hitting right now, unknown feeling inside of an uneasiness that something is up here. And basically, it's our knowing that there's a threat imminent, okay? So this biological imperative works whether you're paying attention or not. And it's based on the function of, like, God, you have to protect this physical entity for, you know, it's for survival. And the moment that I realize, oh, my God, I'm immortal, this weight lift, and what the weight apparently was, I think it was all the energy I was putting into unconsciously with this biological imperative, checking everything out and being on guard all the time, and that disappeared. It was like, wow. It was great because it's the freedom of a kid that's not programmed into the mortality issue and the like, you know, like even if it's mortality, it's like, well, that's 100 years from now. And it's like, that's not even in their mind. But, and so a child doesn't live with that part of its life. It just lives from moment to moment. And after we acquire that awareness, then we start living from moment to moment with vigilance.
Well, that's, exactly. That's what I had found when I, actually in my first book, I had developed something that I called the coherency theory of health and disease, is that when you're frightened, when you're anxious, when you're angry, when you're frustrated, it's almost as if someplace within our minds, within our thinking, within our brain, we are sending information out into all the cells of the body. And each of the cells of the body, according to that holistic approach that I had, we have to look at the cells of the body like being individuals. And they are nurtured by, let's say, the music that the brain plays for them, that our thoughts and the images that are in our mind create a certain kind of melody, as it were, that comes down as and is received by the nerves. And if that melody is chaotic or cacophonous, then you begin to get disordered effects on the cells. For instance, I'd noticed that by talking to people and by my patients who came in with sore throats, I very often found I would ask them, particularly in chronic situations, is there some place in your life now where you're not telling the truth? Are you busy lying about something to someone? Of course, people tell a doctor anything, so yeah, I'm having an affair or this, that, or the other thing, and advise that person if they can move themselves to the point where they're not having to lie anymore, their sore throat would clear up, because the information now reaching their throat is more coherent, and therefore the cells that line their pharynx can secrete the interferon necessary to block the viruses from coming in, and presto, sore throats would clear up. And I saw that in many different ways. So it has to do with the way that you're thinking has a tremendous effect upon what's happening at that lower level. And that of course has to do with our moving out of that Newtonian Newtonian perspective that sees people as being stiff and unchangeable, and instead we're moving more into this sort of quantum direction where we begin to see that that everything is change, and that we can facilitate the kinds of change that we'd like to see. And you state that the conclusions of conventional science are flawed because they're based upon three major assumptions that are no longer valid. Let's talk a little bit about that, science's cherished beliefs.
Yeah, well, it's interesting, Emma, because you actually just summarized my book in one sense of the whole meaning of the biology of belief book, and that cells are indeed the equivalent of miniature people. And because they have all the functions, essentially, that you have in your body are already present in virtually every cell in your body. Every cell's got a respiratory, digestive, reproductive, nervous system, musculoskeletal system, and so on. And so the functions that your human body has are actually capable of being created because cells do those functions. So in truth, then a cell is a miniature person. In truth, a human body, which we frequently misperceive as a single unity, and say, here's Bruce, there's a single human. I go, well, that's a nice statement, but it's an illusion. For a simple understanding is that a human body is made out of 50 trillion cells, and the cells are the living entities. A human, by definition, is a community of 50 trillion cells. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden we look at the perspective different than at a body. Now we look, there's a civilization under your skin of 50 trillion citizens with jobs working in harmony and creating this thing called life and living in their own world like we're living in our world. And there's a government called the mind. And the government is like the broadcast over the internet that all the cells are receiving this broadcast about the conditions of the world and life and all that. So how you and your mind are feeling is being broadcast to 50 trillion cells. And their lives are totally tied into your life. It's sort of like when the government says, oh, my God, be afraid, and every cell in the community of that country is like, okay, I'm afraid. And when the government says, okay, it's safe and the people are safe, well, it's the same in the body. And just to summarize that, was as you were talking about, your thoughts are the equivalent of a government. And when you're in harmony with your thoughts, your body cells become in harmony as a community. And when your thoughts are out of harmony, then your body goes into a disharmony. And it's not just a general disharmony. And that's what the fun part about your point about the sore throat is, that the issues in our mind become complemented in physical presence in the body. And so it's a, you know, it's like not unusual that people who are, excuse me, pissed off are the ones that have urinary infections.
That's right.
Et cetera. So it's interesting because the symptomology is a readout of your government, your mind.
Right.
And it's interesting because, again, when we talk about medicine, they say, well, oh, well, let's cover up the symptom. And it's like, well, that's like your whole population in the country is demanding something, and they say, okay, turn off the telephones and the internet. We're not listening to what they're saying. It's like, that's problematic with conventional medicine. It's like, and your work is so critical in this regard, because it says if you get the government straightened out, then all of a sudden the community can start to run in harmony again. As fast as you change your mind is as fast as the community can change its position. So it's really an interesting part, now that I've varied so far from your original question. You might have to ask me again.
You know, it's that the notion of the survival of the fittest is one that people seem to have accepted, and it's certainly looking as though we really need to go beyond that, because our whole world is developed currently around the notion of polarization. We see it in every area of our lives now, right down to the Congress, which is basically a food fight.
Oh.
You know, rather than a group of people looking to see that we need to work together in order to deal with some incredibly enormous challenges, instead we're throwing rocks at each other, and a lot of that's based upon the kind of thinking that came up with Darwin, survival
Absolutely.
Of the fittest, the survival of the Tea Partiers or whatever. But we need to look at that in a different way, don't you think?
Well, absolutely. This is fundamental. The issue about the beliefs that shape our civilization are based on some kind of truth that we hold, that this must be true, and therefore we must live in this truth that we have created. And the truths that we have created that are account for the current civilization are truths based on science versus truths like the previous phase of our civilization, the church-ran civilization. So if you had issues about life or questions about the world or anything, you always went to the black-coated priest in the church to get your answers. And in the current civilization, we've given the mantle of truth to science. So we look at things as being scientific or not scientific, and then basing our world on what science says. So we ask the guy in the white coat in the science department, and we get totally different answers for this. And what the point is that we take the answers of what they say, how life works, and then mold those answers into behaviors to conform to the way we believe life works. And so, yes, when we start with the Darwinian premise, there's two aspects of Darwinian premise that are destructive of the civilization that we're in. The one you brought up right away was the competition for survival, where we talk about life as a struggle for survival, and we have a competition for fitness. This is a belief, of course, that came in with the Darwinian theory. And when science became the truth provider and people accepted, okay, this is the way life is, they also accepted the reality is then, well, if that's the way life is, then we're all in this struggle to compete with each other, because if we don't, we're going to be eaten by the ones behind us, you know, the fear of you're going to be beaten by the one who's trying to survive while you're not working that hard. So we go out in a rat race world, compete to survive, because our first fundamental belief is life is a fierce competition.
Yeah, which really kind of extends the notion of us battling against Satan. So we really haven't moved much in that direction.
Oh, absolutely. It's just, you know, it's like neither the former or the current ones allow us the positive nature of what life was all about. And this is, you know, for me, why, okay, I'm not into to the current religions as mechanisms. I'm not into the current conventional allopathic medicine as healing. And the reason is because neither of those industries actually offer what they suggest they're providing.
And then, and then the other piece of the Darwinian theory, the second piece of that.
Oh, yeah. Well, okay, so the first one is, why is there competition of violence? Right. Because if we don't, then we already know we're going to die. The second one is much more caustic and responsible for the fact that we're going extinct, as according to science right now. We're deep into the sixth mass extinction. And the reason is this, is that when you buy a Darwinian theory that says, well, how did you get here? And we say, oh, it was random genetic accidents. And then I say, oh, then what was the purpose of your evolution on this planet? And then you'd have to go, well, I guess there wasn't really any purpose because it's just a whole bunch of random genetic accidents. Uh-huh. And then when we disconnect from our connection with the environment, because we say we had no special connection with the environment, we just happened to have the right genetics to be here at this moment, we then see ourselves as separate entities from that environment. Uh-huh. And once you do that, then you look at the environment as an outside thing and you say, oh, God, well, hey, look, let's dig this up and take all this out of the earth and let's throw all our crap over into this pile over here. And, you know, the outside environment is outside. It's somewhere else. And it turns out the new biological understanding is, number one, we are the environment. We were created as a complement. The biology of the human being is a complement to an environment. It was made in a biblical sense in the image of an environment, but biologically it was reflecting what was going on. So when humans were created in what would have been called the garden, a place of harmony and beauty where all the animals and plants really got along with each other. That's what nature is all about. We started in that environment and then at some point said, no, the environment is separate. And then we decided we could do whatever the heck you want to the environment. And then not realizing that what we have done now is altered the environment that we didn't care about to the extent that we as human beings don't really complement the environment that's being created, which means that we will not survive in that world. So this is why science is, you know, giving us the knowledge that we're already facing this mass extinction because of human behavior, because we have destroyed the environment because we thought we were just accidents, when it turns out, simple point, every organism that nature introduced into the environment, she did so to create harmony and balance, so that an environment starts to go out of balance where, and so a new organism comes in, which is, you know, whose behavior will bring it back to balance, but inevitably a new organism also will throw it out of balance. So then nature then goes up the ladder and creates another new organism with a little bit more powerful influence on the environment, with the effort of trying to get to a point of creating a stability in the garden. So now you get to the level of humans, and the fact is, humans are so high in the evolutionary scale and so empowered that if we move left or we move right, we change the environment. And that was nature's, you know, point was, if you bring an intelligent being up to this level, then this intelligent being will ultimately be able to sustain the harmony and balance that the lower organisms, every time they were introduced, brought us a little balance, but then themselves created the imbalance. So nature's thinking, okay, at this level of intelligence, we have an organism that can maintain harmony and balance in the environment, maintain the garden, as the Indians said. And so here we are. Mm-hmm. And then the whole mission statement got totally lost because both the church and science, the previous civilization run by the church, also separated us from nature, because they're saying in the Genesis story was, oh, God created all this stuff and then added us as like an, you know, like an option at the end of the creation story. and so that we were like separate from the environment and just put on top of it. And so that means, again, you and the environment are separate from each other.
Well, when we come back from the break, let's take a look at that.
And yeah,
both of how we can change that external environment and that internal environment, and learn that perhaps our genes aren't really the end of the story. They may determine the color of our eyes, but not everything. Hello again. We're back with Dr. Bruce Lipton, author of The Biology of Belief, Unleashing the Power of Consciousness, Matter, and Miracles. We're touching on the notion of how we actually can have a very profound effect upon our lives, how we can affect the external environment and the internal environment. And a lot of it has to do with what we believe, the images that we hold of the world, and as I like to say, the way we think, the very logical system that we use will have a tremendous effect on the outside and the inside. And you know, we've all heard about genes. Well, you know, my life is controlled by my genes. I had this gene, so I'm going to have high blood pressure. I have that gene, so I'm going to have high cholesterol. And I see people when they, if their parents died, say, if the father died at 64 and a man is about 62 or 63, he's actually thinking, well, I'll probably die because, you know, my father died at that time. And, you know, and sometimes, of course, when you believe something strongly enough, you can bring it about. But what you're saying is that genes don't really cause things like cancer or Alzheimer's disease. Is that right?
Yeah. Genes are blueprints. First of all, it's very important because we have a misunderstanding of genes because they're almost like self-actualizing elements when we talk about, well, a gene turned on and a gene turned off. And it's like, oh, genes make decisions, you know? And it's like, no, first of all, back to square one. A gene is the equivalent of a blueprint. It's an architect's blueprint. It's used to make the building blocks of the body, which are called proteins. So they're like the parts that you assemble. And the character of the proteins give you your physical expression and are related to your behavior. So then you say, oh, well, the blueprints are the genes, and they determine the character of the proteins, which then determines my life traits. And I go, well, cool, except for the new biology, which completely undermines that deterministic point of view that your fate is somehow already predetermined and controlled by your genes. Because the new science is called epigenetic control. And it's like, oh, what's that? And I go, okay, let's go back to the one that most people are trained with. That's called genetic control. And what does this simply mean? Control by genes. I said, yeah, and the new science is called epigenetic control. I said, what does that mean? Well, then I said, that little prefix, epi, turns the world upside down. Because the prefix epi means above. And then so I say, well, what's epigenetic control? And I say, literally, it says control above the genes. So here's what we now know. The concept, the old story, is genes are blueprints. They shape your body, which then shapes your character of your behavior and emotions and all that. So you are somewhat predetermined by these genes and the traits they carry. The new study reveals what? No, genes are blueprints, just like an architect's blueprints. And the mind is a contractor. The mind can adjust the readout of the genes to this extent. So this is like the mind-blowing number that you have to think of. Whoa. Mm-hmm. And it says, every gene blueprint in your body can be modified by your perception of life to alter the blueprint's readout so you can create 30,000 different protein building blocks from the same blueprint. And what that means is, the blueprint is not fixed. The blueprint you can vary to any level you want based on how you live your life. And so all of a sudden it says, oh, then the genes did not create a deterministic outcome. And I say, no, the genes are potentials. They're blueprints. What you do with your genes is how you respond to life and your belief systems, because those are the things that can rewrite your genes. So you can come with a healthy set of genes and then end up with cancer, because the way you selected to read the genes in response to the way you were living. And so now we find, for example, in truth, only about 10% of cancer has any hereditary linkage. 90% of cancer is due to people just to their lifestyle and their perceptions and beliefs, which means, well, if you created the cancer with your lifestyle and perception and beliefs, then changing those lifestyles and beliefs would then also change the cancer. And the answer is, well, yeah, absolutely, that's the way it works. So all of a sudden it said, old story, program the public, you guys are victims. You got genes, they control your life, you didn't pick the genes, you can't change the genes, and therefore you have to live with these genes, which are fate. And then all of a sudden, the new understanding comes in and says, oh, wait a minute, that's not true. Genes respond to your perception, and if you change your perception, you change the readout of the gene, and which automatically says, oh, wait a minute, then I'm in charge of my genes. Because of the way I look at life, I'm in charge of my genes. And I go, yeah, that's what the new biology is about. I go, oh, my God. Then we go from the belief that the mass public holds I'm a victim of my heredity to the absolute opposite understanding. It says, no, I am a master architect of my genes. And so you go from victim to master. But you have to do this with an awareness and a responsibility, because it's our consciousness that is greatly influencing the readout of these genes. And therefore, and as your work has been all about, of course, is adjusting the consciousness to recognize that it is the powerful controller of right. life and not the responding. Some people think like consciousness is the person in the back seat of a vehicle with, you know, hoping that it would turn left and the vehicle frequently turns right and you sit in the back seat going, oh man, life's out of control. And sort of like, and so that's the victim belief. And yet the new biology said, no, you're the driver.
Right. And it's what's so interesting is, anybody who pays any attention to life and how things go rapidly begins to discover that this is true. And so how come that we're not taught that by the system? And the answer, of course, is that we don't have a health care system. We have a sick care system. There are many, many, many billions of dollars that are invested in our continuing to be victims and continuing to get sick. And anything that threatens that is going to be resisted. Just like if you're a drug company and you have a drug like a recent drug here that is estimated to have caused 150,000 premature heart attacks, and yet the drug company is going to defend their use of the drug, you know, not because they really care about people's lives, but they care about that income. And I don't even think people realize that they're doing it.
Uh-huh.
They're immersed in that old belief system. And they have that confirmation bias. That is, you only see the evidence that tells you that you're right. You're sort of a Tea Party kind of person. And what it does, it denies us what we need to know about ourselves. And people so many people think that because they believe something that it's true, and without realizing that beliefs, like emotions and thoughts, are simply behaviors. And when there's a belief that doesn't serve you, and you need to examine that like a scientist and say, hey, believing that I'm a victim is not helping me get well. It's helping me stay sick. And that we're operating according to one kind of logic. But if we switch to another, then we can heal ourselves. So what beliefs turn our influence our genes in the direction that we want to? What way of living and thinking about ourselves?
Well, the most important understanding is, as you brought up, is we have to get over the belief of being victims, which is propagated, as you said, by an industry that makes money on you being a victim. It's the only way it makes money.
Are you speaking of the government or?
I'm talking to the healthcare system.
Okay.
I'm talking especially the healthcare system, which is bankrupting the government right now.
Yeah.
Okay. And especially when you recognize a simple truth that from 50 to 60% of all healing, and that might be a low number, 50 to 60% of all healing is due to the placebo effect, not
That's
to
right.
the actual therapeutic process of the medical industry. So that most of the drugs are placebos. I love like Prozac. Everyone thinks like Prozac is the amazing miracle drug. In laboratory tests, it is no more effective than a sugar pill. That's an absolute fact of life.
Yeah.
But it's a great placebo. It's sold that way, and the belief system of people say, yeah, that's it. And so it works for a lot of people. But the point is, it's all based on this belief system. And the issue is, well, we have to recognize then our beliefs are controlling our biology, and then we have to recognize, yeah, but that comes from our mind. And then I go, okay, and Emmett, I know you have about 5,000 shows here on this on the topic, but if I could just summarize it, the two fundamental subdivisions of the mind, which are interdependent, they're not the same, they work together, but not in the ways that some people think, and that is there's a conscious mind, which is no time limits to the conscious mind. The conscious mind can think into the future. It can review the past. It can disconnect from the moment while it solves problems in your head. And then I say, okay, the conscious mind is the newest evolution of the nervous system. It's the one with your spirit, your identity in it. The conscious mind, being the creative mind, also happens to be the mind that you have your wishes and your desires and your aspirations, because those are things you want to come. So by nature, only a creative mind can do that. That's the conscious mind. So we say, what do you want out of your life? I want all these wonderful things, health, happiness, great job, you know, all these kinds of things. I go, that's great. And then I say, well, then are you finding that in your life? And then people say, well, I'm on the path and I'm always struggling. And then they go, geez, you know, fate is against me because obviously I want these things and I'm having difficulty getting them. So obviously, you know, fate is against me in this, so they see themselves as victims. And it turns out, the truth is, that actually we run our lives only 5% of the time with a conscious mind, and 95% of our life is programmed by the habits in the subconscious mind.
Mm-hmm.
And I say, yeah, but what's the relevance of that? And here comes the tricky part, is that the fundamental beliefs in the subconscious mind were downloaded into the subconscious mind in the first 6 years of our lives, actually starting in fetal development through the first 6 years of our lives. So we are programmed before we get off the ground. And the issue is, well, what's the point is that the programs that got put into our subconscious minds were put in there, and we didn't have consciousness, because that doesn't start as a brain state, a predominant brain state, until after six.
Mm-hmm.
So it says, the first 6 years, you get fundamental programs about life. How do you get them? By observing your parents, your family, and your community, downloading your subconscious mind. They become the basic programs. Then you get conscious at six. Now you could become creative. Yeah, but you become creative with the programs that you
right.
have been programmed
right.
with. So your life is then predetermined to some degree by the subconscious programming. And yet then to own the reality is that the subconscious programs are programs other people put in, not you. So do they necessarily support you? And the answer is, in most cases, no. In most cases, these fundamental programs are disempowering and limiting and to a degree self-sabotaging. And then you go, well, I would know if I was, you know, shooting myself in the foot. And I go, well, that, you see, that was the catch part. It's called subconscious mind because it operates without you being conscious. And it operates because 95% of your time, your conscious mind's not focused on anything. It's flitting around with different ideas and thoughts and things. And the point is, the two minds work together. So if the conscious mind's not focusing on something, then the job of doing that task, whether it's a job at work mm-hmm. or talking to somebody or some behavior, driving the car, that's allocated to the subconscious mind. But because you're not paying attention, then you don't see it, so you don't see your own behavior. And I give the lecture and people laugh because it hits home so much. It's like I say, go back into your life. You have a very close friend, and you know your friend's behavior, and you also know your friend's parent. So at some point, you actually recognize that your friend shares some of the same behaviors as their parent. So, you know, you volunteer very casually. You go, hey, you know, Bill, you're just like your dad. And then, of course, you back away from Bill because he's the guy who's going to vent. Like, how can you compare me to my dad? Which everybody laughs like yourself because, okay, I understand that. And I go, no, let's explain two profound points from the simple story that so profoundly affect our lives. And number one profound point. Everyone else can see that Bill behaves like his dad. It's only Bill who doesn't see it. And I go, what does that mean? He said, the subconscious behavior programs that you got from your parents, you play them subconsciously, so you don't even see you're playing them. And then profound point number two, which is the one that hits home, is we are all Bill. Every one of us. No, it's not Bill who's
That's
playing
right.
these behaviors that he doesn't
That's right.
see. We are as well. And then you come to the point that, well, if you're playing behaviors that were programmed by other people that are in most cases limiting or self-sabotaging, disempowering, and you play these programs but you don't see them,
right.
then that means as you're moving through the day with this great vision of I want all this wonderful success, health, happiness, and I say, yeah, that's great, 5% of the day you're actually on course to go there, and then I say 95% of the day you're on somebody else's track, you don't see it, and most of these programs are preventing you from getting anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden you realize, I'm not a victim of outside forces. I'm a victim of inside programming. And of course, that's the Emmett Miller story right there. So there you go.
That's that's the waking up. That's the coming out of denial, and that's where it's helpful to have a guide or someone to support you, because it's kind of hard to realize that all the pain that you've had or a tremendous amount of it, the relationships that you've screwed up, and the opportunities that you've missed hasn't been because of some evil thing out there. It's because of a way that you were living your life.
Without knowing it.
And of course, denial protects us from that, because the cognitive dissonance that comes when you look at it can be so huge. And that's that's the kind of thing that I use, deep relaxation and guided imagery to try to guide people through, or you can use tapping or EFT approaches, which, as I believe you do.
Well, I basically, it's really interesting. Because when I tell people, okay, look, your conscious mind is that creative mind. It only works about 5% of the time, and that's why you have this difficulty. And then I offer a suggestion, and I say, look, I'm suggesting that there was a time in your life where you were the healthiest you ever were. You had more energy than you could ever deal with at the moment. Life was so beautiful that you couldn't wait for the next day, that you were creating heaven on earth.
Yeah.
And I tell people, okay, let's go back. When you fell head over heels in love with somebody.
Yeah.
And I say, at that period, which I refer to as the honeymoon, life is so beautiful. It's heaven on earth. And I go, you know, this is not a coincidence. This is not an accident. This was a personal creation. You created heaven on earth. And then the question is, well, geez, if it was heaven on earth, how come the honeymoon ended? And the fact is, well, first you have to understand how you created that. And the answer is simply, and I love it because I tell when I give a story in the lecture, people laugh because they're so familiar with it. That I go back and I say, look, the day before you met this person that just blew your mind, I said, how long did it take you to get dressed to get out of the house? And you'd say, oh, okay, 15 minutes I was getting dressed out of the house. Matter of fact, I was thinking about work and all these other things. I just got dressed and left. And then I say, okay, tonight you're getting dressed to go on a date with this person that just, you know, rocked your world, and you want this person so desperately, so in your life. So I say, okay, now you're getting dressed to go on this date. Will it take more than 10 minutes? And the answer is, for, you know, and especially the women laugh, because it could take 2 hours. I say, okay, so I say, what was the difference between yesterday and today? I say, well, yesterday I got dressed because of habit. I get dressed every day. I don't have to relearn how to get dressed every day. It's a habit. I don't need to think about it. I get dressed without thinking about it.
Yeah.
And I say, okay, what about tonight? I say, ah, no, tonight, I'm looking in that mirror. I'm being self-conscious. I'm watching myself,
right.
Meaning I'm not letting it go unless I, as the person scrutinizing this, my conscious mind, accepts this as what I want to represent. I'm not doing it by habit. I'm doing it by conscious control. And then I say, look, and then I'm sitting at the table, and across the table from me is my beautiful partner, Margaret, and before, you know, and I'm at a first date kind of thing with her, and I'm getting, you know, I'm all dressed up, she's all dressed up, we're both behaving because we're both looking at ourselves, making sure we're doing exactly right to keep the other person interested, and I start talking, and like, yesterday I talked to the guys, man, whatever just fell out of my head were the words that fell out of my head. Tonight, before I say the words, I am rehearsing them. I am thinking of poetry because I want this woman to swoon on the table, fall all over the place, because I'm going to say beautiful things. So, and I say, guess what? When we were being self-conscious, we were watching ourselves, listening to ourselves, controlling ourselves day by day. That was called the honeymoon. And when we were living our life to the beliefs that we wanted to live our life, our personal beliefs.
Yeah.
And we were not relying on the habit mind.
Right.
But the honeymoon ends when, look, so much stuff comes into your life. Your head gets so busy, you can't stay focused. So your mind wanders and think about things, job, fix a car, whatever it is. And the moment you're doing that, then guess what? Now you're not being self-conscious. Then your partner comes up after this great relationship, honeymoon period, asks you something sweet and endearing. You turn around and give her something. You know, she looks at you like, where did that come from? Who are you?
Uh-huh.
And the reality is, she just was introduced to your subconscious mind, which is, guess what? Maybe your dad.
Right.
And so, and then all of a sudden, this creates the shock in this person who is like, where did this entity come from in this relationship? I've never seen this before. And then the falling apart of most relationships, as soon as the partner says, well, what kind of behavior was that?
The point here is about becoming conscious.
Yeah.
And living your life consciously.
Yeah.
Rather than letting the reptile rule your life.
Absolutely, that's it, Emmett.
That's wonderful. Been wonderful talking with you, Bruce. We'll have to do it again sometime.
I hope so. That was only the first minute of 12 hours.
And so, to round out today's program, I'd like to offer you a little meditation. And before going into this meditation, I'm going to ask you to give yourself permission to believe that your mind really does have an enormous power, that by guiding your thoughts and your feelings, that you can choose to believe. And that which you choose to believe has a direct impact upon your body, upon your emotions, all the way down to the very genes of your body. Take a deep breath in. As you let it out, the dry lids close. Allow your awareness to go within. Relax those eyelid muscles down to the point they just don't want to open at all. And when you have that relaxation in your eyelids, gently test them. And follow that relaxation from your eyelids throughout all the rest of your body. A very pleasant, gentle flow of peace and tranquility into your forehead and scalp. Through all the muscles of your face, feel your jaw muscle relax. Let that relaxation flow down into your neck and shoulders and arms, down to your fingertips. As it reaches your fingertips, take a deep breath in. Draw it up through your arms into the center of your chest, and as you let that breath out, let it be a feeling of letting go completely, and let the air breathe you. And allow each breath to breathe in oxygen, and along with that oxygen, to breathe in peace and love. As if you're breathing in pure white light. With each breath out, thinking to yourself the words, "It breathes me. It breathes me." And let that relaxation flow down through your chest and abdomen, through your pelvis and your thighs and your knees and your legs and your ankles and your feet, all the way down to the very tips of your toes. And allow yourself to travel to a very special place, your special place, maybe a sacred place, a place of peace and calm, where you're surrounded by serenity. And imagine that you can travel within your own body, and that by traveling within your body, it's possible for you to adjust the genes that determine what happens within your body, your mind, and your emotions. And if there's a problem that you think may have something to do with your genetic makeup, maybe something in your immune system, maybe genes that are switched on that are making it too active, giving rise to allergies or autoimmune problems, or maybe it's underreactive, those switches are switched in such a way that there's just not enough activity in your immune system, the kind of thing that can lead to cancer or chronic infection or inflammation. Imagine you can travel down through your body and actually find those switches. Become aware of those problems that you would like to clear up within yourself that may be related to something at the genetic level, depression, anxiety, breast cancer, asthma, Alzheimer's, whatever it might be, you know what it is for you. What would you like to improve in your life? If there's not a problem that you would like to resolve, think of a way that you would like to function better. And imagine that there are certain genes that you can turn on that will help you focus better and function better, and other genes that you can switch off that will remove extra weight and extra baggage that you don't need to be carrying with you to set you free to perform at your peak. Good. Imagine you can go down inside you as if you're going into a very deep well. Then as you go within you, down through this deep well, you travel around a few corners, and you begin to notice a light in the distance ahead. As the light comes closer and closer, you emerge from this tunnel, and you're in a kind of a long room. And as you look down this room, you'll see that one of the walls is completely covered all the way down by a long line of switches. Some of the switches are switched up, which means those are switched on. Some of the switches are switched down. Those are switched off. And each of these switches is attached to an area on a gene in your body. And that is, it's possible for you to go along, and if there's something within that's overactive, you can switch that switch off. And if there's a gene that's underactive, you can switch it on. And so maybe if you're dealing with inflammation, there are switches that represent overreactivity of your immune system. And if so, imagine you can turn those switches down. Or maybe there are some switches that need to be switched on where you find that there's not enough activity. Imagine yourself walking along, and as you walk along, you notice there are certain switches that are up that need to go down. You'll know which they are. Perhaps they stand out. Maybe they glow, or maybe they have an orange tag on them. But you know as you go. And as you walk down, switching these switches, you're actually walking along the chromosome strand within your body. Now, go back in your imagination to your special place, but picture yourself there looking and feeling really healthy and well. And that situation that you wanted to heal when you're within your body is completely healed. And that part of your body, or those organs of your body that might not have been functioning well before, imagine they're functioning really well. Create an image of perfect health and feel how good it feels. And as you're holding this image in your mind, walk down that row of switches. By holding this image in mind, you will know which switches need to be switched on or off in order to make it come true. Continue to walk down this long hallway. You might find that it kind of swirls around in a kind of helix. As you go along, you're switching all the genes in the way that's going to allow you to perform at your peak and to be your healthiest. Good. Imagine you finished that job now, and just let yourself drift into that perfect image of you looking and feeling the way you really want to look and feel. And know that each time you go within and repeat this process, that you are improving your health and your performance. Let yourself be wide awake now. And if you're interested in other programs that can help you to embody those ideas and perspectives we've explored today, you can find them by going to drmiller.com, that's drmiller.com, clicking on the word store in the upper menu, and then look up Healing Journey, which is a CD or a download, and also the DVD called Power of Your Mind to Heal Your Body. And also check out my book, Deep Healing, The Essence of Mind-Body Medicine. Thanks again to Bruce Lipton. And if you have any questions or comments, join our ongoing conversation at facebook.com/AskDrMiller. Or email me at drmiller@drmiller.com. So, till we meet again, remember, stay tuned.
You've been listening to Dr. Emmett Miller's Healing Times Radio, Conversations with Extraordinary People, on Dream Vision 7 Radio Network. For more information about Dr. Miller's work, upcoming events, new programs, and how you can change your mind and change your life. Visit his multimedia website at drmiller.com. That's drmiller.com. Conversations with Extraordinary People is produced in the drmiller.com studios. Special thanks to Jesse Churchill and Deborah Beauvais. Thank you for listening to publicly supported Conversations with Extraordinary People. If you'd like to support Conversations with Dr. Miller, please visit drmiller.com/conversations and click on the donate button. Also, please join Dr. Miller at the 2-day free conference, 20th anniversary celebration of Cancer as a Turning Point, From Surviving to Thriving, at the Heritage Theater in the San Jose, California area. On the first evening, Friday, September 5th, 7 to 9 p.m., Dr. Miller will offer insights into the mechanisms that make guided imagery so effective. You will also experience guided imagery live with music by jazz harpist Susan Mazur and woodwind performer Dallas Smith. The next day, Saturday, September 6th, the conference continues 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. with 6 inspiring and informative presenters and cameo appearances by Dr. Miller and Susan Mazur. The purpose of this conference is to educate, inspire, connect, and celebrate all whose lives have been touched by cancer or any life-altering condition. This is a great conference for caregivers, family members, friends, physicians, nurses, social workers, and other healthcare providers. For more information about this free 2-day conference, visit healingjourneys.org. That's healingjourneys.org.